Welcome to Crosspoint.
Welcome to Crosspoint.
Welcome to Crosspoint.
We are an inclusive faith community
seeking to live out the loving, just, and generous way of Jesus.
We are participants in a long tradition
that's less concerned with doctrines and dogma that demand total agreement,
but a life to be lived, enjoyed, and given away to others.
What unites us is a growing awareness that life is precious,
that we are made by love in order to love.
This community is comprised of and affirms the entire human family,
regardless of race, age, creed,
physical abilities, marital or economic status,
gender identity, or sexual orientation.
So, if you are curious and have come to see,
if you are tired and have come to rest,
if you are grateful and have come to share,
if you are wounded and have come to heal,
if you are joyful and have come to celebrate,
you are uprooted and have come to belong.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
Today, to start, I want to share something deeply personal with you. It's a confession of sorts, but it is also an emotional journey I find myself in the middle of right now. I think that talking about it will help me move forward and give me some perspective, and it may even help some of you too. My personal issue has to do with Easter. Let me give you some background first. I grew up in the church, and I was a fanatic over Easter. I loved everything about it. The flowers and the pastels, the Easter baskets full of candy, the egg decorating, the special Easter outfits, the multiple Easter egg hunts, and the big family meal that somehow always featured ham. I mean, I loved everything. As I got older, my love only grew. When I started working in churches, I would sing in the choir, performing the most dramatic songs. Up from the grave he arose. Or, he's alive, he's alive. One year, I even wrote a skit about the women at the tomb that debuted in our sunrise service. And of course, once I got married and had kids, I dressed our boys in matching Easter outfits every year and continued the traditions that had been so meaningful for me when I was a kid. Then, Easter 2020 happened. We were all on lockdown. There were no flowery dresses, no special choir numbers, no egg hunts, no people, no one gathering to celebrate. I was so sad that Easter. Even when my sweet husband took out his guitar and sang Easter hymns for me on the couch, I still couldn't stop my tears. I felt devastated, and that devastation led me to start questioning why? Why, if Easter was without the trappings and the dramatics, did it make me so miserable? I mean, it was still a central holiday for the Christian church. It was still Resurrection Day, even without the eggs and the frilly skirts. It was still supposed to matter. The next year, Easter celebrations were mostly back on, but my despair remained. And although I went through the motions of Easter, I didn't feel the same joy and excitement. And finally, I realized why. For several years, even before COVID, I had been celebrating Easter with gusto, all while my beliefs surrounding Easter were going haywire. Because of my deconstruction, which had happened slowly over more than a decade, I was vacillating on my beliefs about Easter. What did the resurrection of Jesus really mean? Was it literally a miraculous resurrection of Jesus's body, or was it more symbolic? Did it even need to be a physical resurrection for it to be meaningful and important? I just didn't know. It's not that I lost my faith. It's just that I had so many questions and doubts that I wouldn't let myself deal with, At least not until the trappings of Easter were taken away from me, and I had to face my own mind without pastel baskets and chocolate bunnies distracting me. And honestly, I'm still in the middle of this questioning and thinking, even now. Since I study the Bible for a living, thinking about faith and Jesus are my job. Don't think that means that I have all the answers about theology or about what is true or what is necessary to believe. But it does help me know where to look for different answers. I say different answers because the Bible doesn't give us one answer to all the questions we have about faith and miracles, about God and salvation. Instead of one answer, it gives us stories. It gives us parables and characters and literary motifs. And so in the midst of my journey of understanding about the resurrection, I went back to the stories. And I found some encouraging ideas in the story of Easter that we read in the Gospel of John. John's account of Jesus's life, death, and resurrection is quite different from the other Gospels' accounts. He crafts stories that help readers find themselves in the narrative. John is especially good at using characters to teach deeper lessons about faith. In John's resurrection story, we find several examples of people who were in various stages of understanding and faith when it comes to Jesus and his resurrection. The first example is Mary Magdalene. Mary is the one who finds the empty tomb in John. She runs to tell the disciples about it, but her first assumption is not that Jesus had risen from the dead, but that someone must have moved Jesus's body. She goes back to the tomb eventually and sees Jesus himself, but she doesn't recognize him at all. She thinks he's the gardener. This key disciple of Jesus, Mary Magdalene, who followed him to the cross and showed up at the tomb, was quite lost when it came to understanding the resurrection or even recognizing Jesus. But she is not reprimanded by Jesus at all for her misunderstanding. On the contrary, Jesus commissions her to go tell the other disciples where he was going. Mary is not the only one to struggle with believing in Jesus' resurrection. John tells us that two of the most famous disciples of Jesus, Peter and the beloved disciple, who might be John, run to the tomb after Mary reports that it's empty. And when they peek inside, they don't recognize what was going on either. As John tells us in chapter 20, verse 9, Peter and the other disciple didn't yet understand the scripture that Jesus must rise again from the dead. They are eyewitnesses to the empty tomb, and they have no idea what's going on. And what about the rest of the disciples? Mary comes to them later saying, "I have seen the Lord." But they don't run into the streets to rejoice. They stay hidden in a room, petrified of the Jewish authorities, until Jesus later shows up right in the middle of them to alleviate their fears. And that brings us to another famous disciple, Thomas. He has been known throughout history as Doubting Thomas. And that name is always uttered with disapproval, even judgment, as if Thomas was somehow less than the other disciples. I have issues with this negative assessment of Thomas. We just did a brief rundown of all the other disciples and their reactions. They misunderstand, they have trouble recognizing Jesus, and they doubt their own eyes at the tomb. Is it really fair to single out Thomas as less than when everyone else seemed to have difficulty believing that Jesus was alive? Or put another way, does John intend for us to judge Thomas harshly in his gospel? Is Thomas set forth as a negative example? We are going to have to dig deeper into the story for answers to those questions. So we read in John 20, 24 through 25, that, quote, Thomas, the one called Didymus, one of the 12, wasn't with the disciples when Jesus appeared to them that first time. The other disciples told him, "We've seen the Lord." But Thomas replied, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands, put my finger in the wounds left by the nails, and put my hand in his side, I won't believe." I don't know. This passage just makes Thomas sound like a realist to me, an empiricist. He would make a great post-Enlightenment thinker. He just wanted to see Jesus, to see some evidence. That was what the other disciples needed too. Thomas is no different than them. The others did not believe until they saw Jesus and his wounds. But to get a better idea of what John is trying to show us with Thomas, let's learn a little bit more about him. Thomas speaks two other times in John, first in chapter 11 and then in chapter 14. In John 11, Jesus has just heard that his friend Lazarus is sick. He says to his disciples, "Let's return to Judea again." The disciples are kind of shocked. Rabbi, the Jewish opposition wants to stone you, but you want to go back there?" Jesus explains, "Our friend Lazarus is sleeping, but I'm going in order to wake him up." The disciples don't get it. Lord, if he's sleeping, he will get well. So Jesus has to be more obvious. "Lazarus has died," he says. "For your sakes, I'm glad I wasn't there so that you can believe. Let's go to him." And here's the part where Thomas comes in. Thomas, the one called Didymus, said to the other disciples, "Let us go too, so that we may die with Jesus." What does this passage show us about Thomas? I mean, like the other disciples, he doesn't get Jesus' message about Lazarus the first time around. But once he does, his reaction is quick and decisive. He shows bravery and faithfulness. He is ready to die with Jesus as a loyal follower. And so what about the next time we see Thomas in John? In chapter 14, it is the night before Jesus is going to die, and he is giving his disciples some last instructions before he leaves. "Don't be troubled," Jesus says. "Trust in God. Trust also in me. My Father's house has room to spare. If that weren't the case, would I have told you that I am going to prepare a place for you? When I go to prepare a place for you, I will return and take you to be with me, so that where I am, you will be too. You know the way to the place I'm going." And what is Thomas's response? A follow-up question, maybe for clarification. He says, "Lord, we don't know where you're going. How can we know the way?" In this passage, Thomas sounds honest and questioning, asking Jesus how he can follow him. He really wants to know and understand where Jesus is going. He just can't see the way yet. He wants to gather evidence to know what to believe and how to believe and what he should do. He was willing to follow Jesus to death, as we learned in chapter 11, but he just needed to know the way. Both of these passages get us ready for the last time we encounter Thomas in John, after Jesus has appeared to the other disciples and Thomas missed it. Thomas wants to see Jesus, and he wants to feel his wounds. The man he was willing to follow to death had died, but Thomas was still alive. Maybe a part of Thomas didn't want Jesus to be alive, because then he would have to face the fact that he didn't go and die with Jesus. But mostly, it seems that Thomas was waiting to see his rabbi in the flesh, doubting the word of his fellow disciples, but still hoping that the resurrection was true. Because when we see Thomas a week later, he is still hanging out with the disciples, waiting to see if Jesus would make an appearance. Let's see what Thomas has to say when Jesus finally does appear to him in John 20, 26 through 29. After 8 days, his disciples were again in a house, and Thomas was with them. Even though the doors were locked, Jesus entered and stood among them. He said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here. Look at my hands. Put your hand into my side. No more disbelief. Believe." Thomas responded to Jesus, "My Lord and my God." Jesus replied, "Do you believe because you see me? Happy are those who don't see and yet believe." It's a dramatic scene. Jesus surprises the disciples as he shows up in the locked room, but the narrator doesn't tell us how Jesus did it. Did he pick the lock, push through the door, dematerialize and appear on the other side? We don't know, because that is not John's concern here. John wants us to focus on Jesus and Thomas. It's as though Jesus is breaking into the room for the sole purpose of giving Thomas what he needs. And isn't it interesting that Thomas had wanted to see Jesus and touch his wounds, but when Jesus invites him to touch, he doesn't need to. Nowhere does John say that Thomas actually touched the wounds. Instead, Jesus shows up, speaks to him, and then, without accepting Jesus' invitation to touch, Thomas has an epiphany, uttering the central and climactic statement in the Gospel of John, "My Lord and my God." Up to this point in the story, John has been very loudly hinting at a key point that he's trying to communicate about Jesus, that Jesus is one with the Father. Jesus himself says it in different ways throughout John, but it isn't until now that someone says out loud that Jesus is Lord and God. And who says it? The guy we disparage, known as Doubting Thomas. I think that we make Thomas into a second-class believer because of one of the lines Jesus says in this scene. "Do you believe because you see me? Happy are those who don't see and yet believe." I think people assume that John is holding up those who don't see and yet believe as greater followers of Jesus. And that's probably because most Bible translations render the word makarios as blessed or blessed. Blessed are those who don't see and yet believe. But that Greek word is best translated as happy, content, or at peace. It does not imply that God blesses those people. It's a simple adjective, happy. And isn't that a true statement? People who have that simple kind of faith, the kind that doesn't ask questions or have doubts or require evidence, yeah, they're pretty undisturbed, blissfully happy even. But is that what the goal is? Is John trying to tell us that we should all believe without seeing, without reasoning or questioning? I don't think so. No one in this story believes like that. They all have to see Jesus to believe that he is resurrected. So to answer my question about Thomas, no, I really do not think John is setting up Thomas to be a negative example of belief. As we saw, Thomas is dedicated to Jesus, willing to die for him, and so invested in understanding Jesus' teaching that he asks questions. He doubts when the disciples tell him about Jesus' resurrection, but he also sticks around to wait for Jesus to appear, full of curious inquiry and a desire to find evidence of the resurrection. He may not have swallowed the story without proof, but he does seem to hope that the testimony of his fellow disciples is true. There certainly is a peace and contentment that people feel when they accept miracles like the resurrection without hesitation, without questions or doubts. I know, because I was one of those Jesus followers who didn't need to see to believe. But now that I am being honest with myself, now that I'm thinking, questioning, even doubting, I think there is a beauty in that as well. I relate so much to Thomas in his reluctance, in his empiricism that demands evidence, in his desire to confirm the unknown and impossible. And all of those things are okay. In fact, I think the gospel writer expects it. That is why he tells these short stories about the disciples after the resurrection. He talks about Mary Magdalene's misunderstanding and Peter's reluctance to believe, about the other disciples, including Thomas, needing to see Jesus to believe. John wants us to know that in that space between seeing the empty tomb and experiencing Jesus in the wounded flesh, it is perfectly human to doubt and to question. Those characters in the story ended up believing, but only when they saw the resurrected Jesus right in front of them. You and I have not experienced that yet. We are living in that space between the empty tomb and the face-to-face with Jesus. We are no different than the disciples when we question, when we long for evidence, even when we doubt. So don't let anyone disparage you by calling you a doubting Thomas. You question, I question, because we care and we are searching for the truth. Easter, at its core, when you strip away the bunnies and the baskets, is not about certainty or blind faith. That's not what John's story tells us. Instead, Easter is about the search for truth and the patient hope that one day we will see more clearly. For now, though, the questions and the doubts keep us engaged in the journey. To close, I have a prayer I want to share with you. It's a prayer for doubters called A Door to Discovery. How strangely comforting, Lord, that so many of your servants have doubted you. So, if I cannot always see the sense of your word, if I do not always feel confident about my faith, if I wonder where your love is in the face of pain and death, I am not the first. A great company of saints and martyrs has felt this way before me. Now, in your presence, they see face to face and know as they are known. Teach me, like them, not so much to fear doubt as to see it as a sign of the mystery of life and a door to discovery.
If you would like to know more or get connected to Crosspoint, go to crosspoint.org. If you're in need of care or assistance, go to crosspoint.org/care. And welcome home.